You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
Welcome back to the show, people.
Yeah.
Number 54. Oh, yeah, we are dead center in the middle of October here. Probably my busiest month in the year. So if I sound a little weird, that's because my voice is pretty much shot.
And why does your voice sound shot?
Oh, because I've been yelling people at Netherworld every night. Oh, there's only so many like monster screams you can do before it just like you go into full lockdown.
I think you should take some death metal voice acting or something. Yeah, you know.
Welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast.
That's pretty brutal.
We should start a band this month. So
yeah, but you could only make it through like five, you know, like lines of one song. You'd be like, nope, throat's dead, done.
I mean, then you just play music the whole time. I mean, you don't really have to make any sense.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole like 20-minute guitar solos really aren't a thing anymore. People don't appreciate that as much as they used to.
I mean, it's death metal. You don't really have to say anything. No one understands you anyway, so you can just sit there and grunt for 5 minutes and
just stick your head in the toilet.
Yeah, exactly. So what are we smoking this week?
This week we are smoking something brand new from CAO. This is the Consigliere.
This stuff is so new, it wasn't even on the shelf when we picked it up. It like just came in.
What?
And if, this is like I said, we talked to Ricky Rodriguez a month or so ago, and he was kind of, we didn't get it on the mic, but he told us about this was going to be on the horizon. And it's kind of their mafia-themed cigar, because Consigliere is, it's like kind of like a
you're
soldier,
the boss.
Part of the family, if you will.
It's not the soldier, it's the boss.
Well, we're smoking the soldier, because each of their sizes are named after the soldier, the boss, or what is the third one?
So you got the soldier, which is your Toro. This is a 6x54. You've got the boss, which is the torpedo. It's the larger
7x56.
And then you've got the associate, which comes in at a 5x52.
Yep, so.
But I'm really digging this cigar. It's got a Brazilian wrapper, Honduran binder with Colombian, Dominican, and Nicaraguan fillers. One of the things that I'm digging about it is this cigar has actually got a little kick to it. So I'm going to say that this is probably more medium full, where a lot of CAO stuff tends to be more medium. So, you know, the fact that, you know, this
well,
is...
I don't know. You start talking about, like, the flathead and stuff. That stuff's definitely a full...
Yeah, I mean, maybe the flathead, but, you know, and maybe not necessarily the full flavor, but I'll say that the complexity is there. I mean, I get a lot of spice, I get a lot of, you know, other hints and flavors there, so, you know, it's definitely not just, you know, a lot of times when I smoke the flathead, it's consistent from start to finish, you know, where this here, it's got, you know, some other flavors, mixed in. And I think that's just because of the different fillers here. So, you know, really digging the cigar so far.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've had anything with a Brazilian wrapper, too. That kind of mixes things up a little bit. I feel like I should be wearing a fedora right now. I mean, we are smoking the Mafia Oso cigars here.
Yeah, but, you know, as we segue into the main segment, do we really want to be, you know, on these guys' bad end? Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we've got, you know, we run into town,
just
guns you're
part of the
blazing.
Mafia, don't mean you have to be on the bad side. I mean, sometimes the guys take care of their neighborhood. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe. That's a fine line. I don't know.
But yeah, this week we're going to be talking about some Westerns, specifically The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, so we're actually going to talk about, you know, the original, 1960. And then who knew that there were like three other films after that. And then we had the remake, which I gotta say, I thoroughly enjoyed.
Well, we'll save that for the main segment. But yeah, I mean, back on the cigars, the box too, just a bright red. I mean, it's not a whole lot of graphics to it, but it stands out and is like classic with also being new. So it and like I said, the label's just CAO in that red and black. I mean, it's like the mafia, yeah, traditional, but it also standing out. And so yeah, I mean,
it's vintage with an urban flair.
And not a bad price point either, between like 8 and 10, I think.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about CAO, man. For by and large, you're getting really, really good quality for very good price. And I mean, that's the thing. Like, I think it's because they don't spend so much on their packaging and, you know, the other materials. They just put out a good product with a good brand and say, here, have at it. And, you know, it's consistent, it's tried and true. And I don't think I've had anything bad from CAO.
Yep. And with that, we'll be right back with the main topic.
Stay tuned.
Don't you ever be sad. All you don't need when the times get bad. When a day comes, you are down in a river of trouble.
And welcome back. Saddle up your horses. It's time to ride.
Do I get whiskey for my men and beer for my horses?
Yes.
Yes. Cool.
Yeah, and this week we are talking about one of the probably the greatest westerns of all time, The Magnificent Seven. And I gotta say, since normally and traditionally I hate remakes and reboots, and we'll get into the new movie here in a little bit, but I gotta say, this is what you should do if you are going to do a remake or a reboot. Stop rebooting shit from like 5 years ago. Instead, reboot something that most people today don't know about or haven't seen in a very long time.
Yeah, and you know, I think it really helps to do it right.
Yeah. I mean, because this movie, the original one, was released in 1960. So most people that saw that brand new are, yeah, really old now, if they're even around. Like, so like I said, I only saw this on video as a child. Like I said, reboot stuff that you can actually maybe improve by doing a remake, or something that's so old that there's a lot of new fans that don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, like I said, things should be at least 40, 50 years old before you start freaking remaking it. And this movie itself was sort of a remake as well, because it was inspired by the movie Seven Samurais by Akira...
Kurosawa.
Yeah, Kurosawa, who was like famous samurai movie maker back in the day. I mean, the original came out in 1954. And it was basically the same theme as Magnificent Seven, as we'll get into it, of a team of rogue samurai defending a village from marauders.
Ah, oh, those damn marauders. Yeah, I gotta say, going back and watching the 1960 movie, if I saw it when I was younger, I really didn't remember seeing it. So, you know, going back and watching it now, I was like, you know, I find myself really starting to get into more of these old Western movies. Like, I'd always, you know, pass by my grandfather or something who from, you know, start of the morning to, you know, the end of the evening before dinner was, you know, always watching Western films. So, you know, I got exposed a little bit to it, but, you know, sitting down and watching it, I'm like, damn, that's legitimately funny. Or, you know, yeah.
And probably one of the most American forms of filmmaking. I mean, it's a genre that's been around forever. And the Old West we see on the TVs ain't the real Old West, but it's something that's always inspired the imagination. Even the ones that weren't made here in America. I mean, if you've ever heard the term spaghetti Western, it was cheaper to film in Italy. So a lot of like the early cheap Westerns were made in Italy, even though they were like, you know, kind of synonymous with America.
Yeah. Which I don't know. I mean, I think that's, to your point, one of the things that I really like about the Western films is, you know, it definitely, you know, does gravitate to that, you know, Americana. And, you know, we live in such a politicized environment today and everything else that, you know, it's kind of good, you know, there's to go back and, you know, see some of that history and everything.
And like the landscapes and stuff are always just, you know, beautiful.
Oh, they've got gorgeous landscapes.
The unspoiled American West is probably one of the greatest things you can see.
Yeah, a non overly commercialized America is a thing of wonderment. Like, I mean, and to this day, like, there's still, you know, a part of me that wants to go out, you know, into the Midwest, you know, where it's just hundreds of miles of, you know, wilderness and everything else. And, you know, when I think of a vacation, I don't think of, oh, let me go to this big city. Let me go. No, I want to go somewhere where there's streams where I can trout fish. There's peace and quiet. I'm not surrounded by the hustle and bustle of everyday life and technology. It's truly an escape. So, you know, watching films that revert back, you know, to a time, you know, when we didn't all have everything. And Google, you know, didn't control the world.
I've gotten accused of having kind of an older mentality of, you know, because I spent a lot of time raised by my grandparents. So I grew up on Westerns and kind of that old school work ethic mentality where it's like a man... Well, was a man, yeah. Like I said,
was a man because you had to, you know, you live and died by your hands. I think
People like, I don't see how you keep going on. I'm like, you go on because you have no other choice. I mean, and that's the way, you know, our grandparents' generation was. Is like you work as hard as you can until you can't anymore, and then you do it again. You know, you fight until you can't, you know, fight anymore, and then you take another swing because you only fail when you stop to get up. It's like Rocky said, you know. It's not how hard you hit, it's how hard you can get hit and still get up. And I think, you know, growing up on Westerns and stuff, that's kind of like where you learn to be a man. Like, you know, the hero was always, you know, he knew how to shoot, he knew how to fight, but he was also a good dude. Treated women right, treated the community right, smoked a cigar, drank his whiskey, but at the end of the day, he was a good dude that you could depend on and would, you know, never give up.
Well, I mean, I think this goes back to a time where, you know, your name really meant something. And your character, you know, if you wanted to, you know,
your word was
have
your bond.
Some of the comfort, exactly, you know, where, you know, actions definitely spoke louder than words. Whereas, you know, in today's society, that's not so much. It's, you know, there's so much that you can get, you know.
A lot of talk, a lot of that,
you know,
a lot less action.
I believe there was a song that talked about that.
Yep. Some Elvis.
It was a little bit later than Elvis.
I know Elvis did a version of it. It was a little...
A lot more talk and
a
little less talk.
A little less talk, a lot more action.
Yeah. I forgot the country singer that did that. But
I remember the Elvis version. But Magnificent Seven, like I said, that came out in 1960 and was almost like, you know, the Avengers of Western because it had... all the big name actors of the time. I mean, this was a huge movie, directed by John Sturges,
yep.
Starring Yul Brynner as Chris Adams, Steve McQueen as Vin Tanner, Horst Burkholz as Chico, Charles Bronson as Bernard O'Reilly, Robert Vaughn as Lee, and James Coburn as Britt, and Brad Dexter as Harry Luck. But, I mean, James Coburn and Robert Vaughn, I mean, those guys have been in a lot of movies.
Yes.
I mean, they were like every Western or every old war movie had at least one of those guys in it. And Charles Bronson was the Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, the badass of the 60s. I mean, there's between the 60s and the 70s, he was the action star.
Yep.
From, what is it, Death Wish and all that stuff. I mean, he was like, I mean, pretty much Chuck Norris before Chuck Norris.
Man, speaking of which, like, I need Chuck Norris and more stuff, too. Like, I mean, that's who I grew up with, you know, as far as, you know, I guess if you... You know, he was the Texas Ranger, so it's not really Western, but it's still Texas, but...
I mean, when in Texas, look behind you. Yeah. That's where the Ranger's going to be. Oh, man.
And any train of thought I had, it just went way out the window.
That show is still on, too, man. It's like middle of the days on some off channel. There's still some Texas Ranger going on.
But, yeah, I don't know, man. I really love the whole premise behind the Magnificent Seven. You know, you have somebody come into town that's looking to, you know, basically turn your world upside down, steal you of your land, everything else. And, you know, here it is. You know, you got a group of gunfighters, you know, that band together and they teach, you know, everyday villagers, people that, you know, really never brandished a firearm or, you know, never had to really, you know, fight, just... You know, hey, you got to make a stand, otherwise you're just going to get ran over.
That's one thing I like. Well, for one, you know, the opening scene of the movie, you see the Calavera, who is the bandito boss, coming to the town to threaten all the poor villagers. And the way they establish that he is a bad person is he steals all the cigars.
Yes.
He sits down with, like... the shop owner and basically threatens them all, and like, yeah, but he's being very cordial about it, and yeah, smokes a cigar, and the guy's got like a whole jar full of cigars, so he's like, we're gonna be back and we're gonna take everything, and if y'all resist, we're gonna kill you, and then takes all the cigars out of the family. I'm like, take a man's land and his money, take his cigars, that's just cruel.
Yeah.
But then all the villagers are like, because we've talked about before of old man strength being the strongest. All the old villagers, like, they're like, what should we do? Some of them, like, we should resist. Some of them, we should run. They're like, let's go ask the old man. The old man will know what we do. So they all ride up to the old man that lives on the outskirts of the village, the elder, and he's like, y'all should fight.
I mean, that's you know, kind of the thing is, you know, unfortunately, it becomes a fight for your survival. And, you know, if you don't stand up, you know, for yourself, it doesn't matter what anybody else does. You know, somebody could come in, save the day, but if you're not willing to fight, then once that person's gone, you're left on your own, and you're just going to crumble.
Yeah, and I like, you know, they decide they're going to ride to him. He's like, ride to America. There's lots of guns there. You can buy guns in America, which is kind of ironically funny. But, you know.
It's true.
When they get to the first, like, Western town they come to, how they kind of establish that Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen are the good guys is there's a supposed to be a funeral going on for a townsperson who had died, and this traveling salesman from out of town is like, I saw this guy like die in the streets in front of me, and people just stepped over him for 2 days, so I'm paying for this man to have a proper funeral. And the funeral director is like, hey, I'm with you, I will have a proper funeral, but I can't because there's an element in the town that don't like him because he was an Indian, and they don't want him buried in a white man's graveyard, even though that everybody up there were killers and gunslingers. So he's like, even my, you know, hearse driver has quit. You know, I can't get anyone to bury this man. And, you know, Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen stuff up like, hey, if the only thing holding this up is you don't have anybody to drive the hearse, you know, we'll take care of it. Yeah. And they, you know, basically force the town people to bury this, you know, man that died. You know, and then the only reason they didn't want him in their graveyard is because he was an Indian. And they're like, all right, these are some good dudes. They should be the ones that would, you know, help save our poor Mexican village.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you see those themes, you know. Unfortunately, a lot of times when, you know, you talk about Westerns or whatever, you know, the issues of race and, you know, segregation and stuff always tends to come up. But, you know, I really dig some of these films because it shows that not everybody is that way, that there are legitimately good people that are willing to put by any bias or whatever, just to do the greater good for their fellow man.
Yeah, and also, like, in that scene, too, establishing that they're not only good guys, but they're total badasses, because freaking Yul Brynner is smoking a cigar, you know, puts a cigar in, lights it up, they start their ride. Somebody takes a shot at him, blows the tip of his cigar, he doesn't even flinch. They take a shot back, and he just throws the cigar away, pulls out another one, lights it up, and continues on his way.
I'd have to say, man, that'd be a pucker up moment. Holy shit.
And then later on, when they're kind of assembling the team, Chico, which is like the young, inexperienced, hothead kid that decides to, you know, basically forces them to take him on by trying to prove himself. He like follows them all the way to Mexico and stuff, and they're finally like, all right, come on, kid. But he tries to shoot, and he doesn't even react. He just sits there, and the guy like takes two shots at him and misses, and he just like no reaction whatsoever. Everyone is just like, yeah, we're just going to finish our drinks. And even when you see James Coburn's character, who is his thing is he's like the knife expert. He's a guy who is like at the top of his game with knife and gun. And like they say, like a man like this, money doesn't matter to him. He just wants to be the best. So he's the only reason why he wants to come along is just to prove that he wants to continually test himself. And like you see him, like someone trying to bully him into a fight, and he don't care. He's just sitting there taking his nap. Guy shoots at him. He doesn't even react until he finally like, you know, calls him a coward. And he's like, all right.
Yeah, yeah, I got to defend my honor at this point. And
it's your funeral, you know. Like, I tried to let you go, but you're a dumbass. I want to fight, so.
Yeah, some of the knife skills, man. Like, I almost feel like that's a lost art. Like.
You don't see many knife fighters anymore. Except for, you know, when they remake Westerns, which we'll talk about here in a bit.
But it's always just so badass. I don't know. Like, I don't know if we talked about on the podcast. Watching some of the Cold Steel stuff and just like some of the badassery that goes on, I'm like, damn.
Yeah, I need me a good knife for my EDC. But yeah, this, I mean, when they finally do go to Mexico and try to defend the town and start trying to train these people to protect themselves, it eventually backfires. I mean, they can't make a soldier out of a farmer, and they just basically lay down and let the bad guys take over the town and run all them off. But they're like, no, we got to, you know, they could have just left free and clear. The town's like, no, we'll take it in the butt from the bad guys. Y'all just go on back to America. But, you know, men of honor, you know, they can't let that shit stand. They're like, you know, we've got to go back and save these people, even though they don't want to be saved. And yeah, you know, at the cost of their lives and everything else. But I think like back in those days, I mean, your honor meant more than your life nearly.
No, I mean, that was the thing is, you know, you live by your honor, you die by your honor. I mean, you know, yeah, there was wealth and everything else, but, you know, that really didn't matter as much as what a person's character did. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, a lot of Western films really conveyed quite well is character was much more important than any social class. You know, and it was a time of, you know, doing the right thing. And, you know, I mean, I think that's a principle and a philosophy that if we could, as a society, adopt today, we'd all be in a much better place.
Plus, we could all start wearing cowboy hats again and look cool. I mean, I want to wear a Western rig, just, you know, modern gun, but, you know, you just walk around with, like, you know, 1911 in a Western style holster. Yeah, go back to being cowboys. So those boots suck. I'm like, no.
Yeah. I was about to say, like,
a little hard on the feet.
It's been a long time since I had a pair of cowboy boots on, and I can say it wasn't exactly a pleasant feeling. But I had friends that would wear them from day in and day out every single day. I'm like, I don't know how you do it, but. Yep. It must have been better boots than I had.
You're a little bit more country than me, if you can do that. But this movie also inspired a lot of things to come. I mean, later on we get The Dirty Dozen, also starring James Coburn. I think Bronson might even been in that too. But there, I mean, I remember like seeing a series of movies where a team of mercenaries, ex-soldiers, whatever, step up to defend the defenseless. I mean, there's like I said, we wouldn't, like I said, the Dirty Dozen, we, was it, even the A-Team was inspired by the Magnificent Seven. And I think, how was it, either Carburn or Vaughn, one was like the original one that was, that they approached to play Hannibal before they got George Peppard. So, I mean, it's basically the same thing. It's four mercenaries who are defending the defenseless. And you kind of see that theme in other things as well. I remember, and I can't, I'm blanking on the name right now, but there was like another movie in like the 80s or whatever that was about a biker gang that were like, we were all like vets.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, this kind of like, you know, we want to be free. We're going to be a biker gang, but they come across this town that's getting harassed by a gang or something. And these, you know, this like, you know, small 7-8 man biker gang decides to protect this town. And I mean, it's like,
and then you got the modern day Wild Hogs that, you know, piggybacked off that principle. Like, I mean, it's been a theme that we've seen, you know, throughout many films. But I don't know. I mean, you know, it just leaves you, you know, with a sense of purpose and a feel good and a restoration in humanity. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, because I mean, I took a film class once in college, and they're basically, the guy said, they're like, there's no new stories. There's just different ways of telling the same stories. So it's like, you know, the Seven Samurai got us Magnificent Seven, and Magnificent Seven got us all these other things. I mean, it's all the same story, just different ways of doing it. And if you do it well, you don't even realize that, oh, this is the same thing I've seen 5-6 times down the road. So it's like, you know, instead of making reboots and, I mean, just tell a new story, even if it's the same story, but just tell it new.
Yeah.
I mean well, people got lazy. Back in the day, like, oh, Seven Samurai, I like that. I'm going to make Magnificent Seven. But now they're like, oh, no, we're just going to make Magnificent or Seven Samurai over and over again.
It's like there's only so many ways to do that.
Yeah. Like, don't call it the same thing. Slap a new name on it. Change it up a little. Do something creative.
But, you know, I mean, I'm with you. You know, I've got my qualms with, you know, just straight up trying to retell the whole story. But I don't know. You know, the way that, you know, the Magnificent Seven film that just came out, you know, a few weeks ago, you know, even though it's a dead-on remake, it...
But even then, it's not... I
mean, it doesn't really feel the exact same, yeah.
Because they're not using the same characters. They kind of keep the same character archetype. Like, you can definitely see parallels between the original Seven and the new Seven, but they're new characters. It's not a band of banditos. It's a corrupt mining baron. You know, like I said, they mixed it up enough where, yes, it is going by the same title, but it's a completely different movie other than a few key scenes, key jokes, key lines that you know, cross over.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things about, you know, Magnificent Seven, you know, the 1960 version. You know, what is it? We were talking about it prior to recording where, you know, the kid's like, yeah, I'll make sure that, you know, your rifles are taken care of, that you'll always have, you know, new flowers on your graves.
Yeah, there's these three kids that befriend Charles Bronson's character, and they're like, what are you doing? They're like, oh, we draw straws. We got you. And he's like, what are you talking about? He's like, well, we agree that, you know, if you are to die, we will pick up your guns and avenge you, and we'll make sure you always have flesh flowers on your grave. And he's like, oh, that's a big comfort. And they're like, see, we told you would like it.
But, I mean, that was like one of those big, like, you know, it was heartfelt, but it was kind of lighthearted at the same time.
Or even Steve McQueen has some great lines. And Chris Pratt, as which we'll get into, pretty much repeat like Steve McQueen's best lines, but they still resonate and they still great. Like the one where when they go to meet the old man to try to get him to come into the village to protect him, and he's like, "Yeah, I'll stay out here." They're like, "Well, what about, you know, the threat?" And he's like, "I'm like 90, you know, I don't care. Like, what's he gonna kill me for? I'm like, I'm an old man." And he's like, "Well, why are y'all doing this?" And he's like, "Steve McQueen's like, oh, it reminds me of a guy I knew back home that jumped out of fell off a 10-story building." He's like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah. Every floor he passed, you know, people heard him say, 'So far, so good.'" He's like, "Yeah, so far, so good." It's a smooth ride until it's not, you know? Yeah. Or the other one, when someone was like, when the bad guys take over the town and he's trying to ask them why they would take this job in originally, and Yul Brynner is like, the moment I can't really tell you, and he's like, come on, tell me. And Steve McQueen's like a man I knew once that took off all his clothes and jumped into a cactus. I asked him the same thing. He's like, what'd he say? He's like, seemed like a good idea at the time.
That's all bad. Yeah. All bad. Like, I was at a Taco Bell the other night, and the back of the building is like just surrounded by cactus. Like, it's so weird. Like, I mean, they're like 6 foot high, you know, they got the freaking big bulb on the top that you know is gonna, yeah, you know, sprout one of the flowers and stuff. And I was just, I remember sitting in my car, you know, just looking over, and I was like, why would anybody in their right mind jump into one of these? Or, you know,
I've seen videos like people on a dare grabbing one of the small ones with their bare hand to see who could hold on long enough. I mean, people are stupid.
That's the Darwinism at work.
Yeah, just clean out the gene pool.
Yes.
Like, I see the Western too. I mean, I'm glad with this movie, and what, a year ago we had the Hateful Eight and Django. It seems like the Western is making a comeback, and I'm glad to see that, you know, coming back into pop culture.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we've seen it. I mean, I was just, you know, what was it? Vintage Tomorrow on Netflix, like, you know, like finding steampunk, you know, documentaries and stuff like that. Like, you know, it's kind of crazy how, you know, some of this stuff is starting to come around into, you know, more pop culture. You know, before it would be, you know, congoers and stuff like that, but, you know, stuff is really starting to branch out. And, you know, I mean,
the Western's kind of like played out in the 80s, but now it's like, I mean, it's back with a vengeance, and the technology of filmmaking has improved to the point where it looks good.
It's kind of interesting.
It looks like the American West and stuff.
It's interesting the way that we're seeing films and, you know, giving all the technology, like we're trying to use our technology to make the films have that, you know, old appearance, you know, so it's just kind of cool to, you know, just kind of see how, you know, history does kind of repeat itself.
Yeah, and so let's kind of talk about the new movie for a bit. So if you haven't seen it yet, you know, spoiler alert from here on in. 2016's Magnificent Seven, directed by Antoine Fuqua, which you may remember from a little movie called Training Day.
Yes.
And I saw an interview with him, and because he's known for making these like gritty urban movie action movies and stuff. But they're like, you know, you're making a Western now. And he's like, dude, I've always been making a Western. It's like every movie to me is a Western. He said Training Day was a Western, you know. So it's kind of cool seeing him finally live out his dream to do a real Western.
And he did it, you know, spot on. Yeah. Like, I mean, I got to say, like, I you know, I kind of had my doubts going into the movie, like, not really sure what I'm about to see. I'm like,
yeah,
it's going to go one or two ways. Either I'm going to really like it or I'm going to really hate it. You know, I don't really see an in-between for me. And, you know, I got to say, man, I was damn surprised. And I, you know, it was really funny watching Denzel Washington's character and his interaction. And like the entire time, like he's doing like this almost Morgan Freeman-esque, you know, like speech. And I'm like, is this really Denzel Washington? Like, you know, like I keep hearing Morgan Freeman's voice in the way that, you know, he's portraying himself.
Yeah, Denzel Washington playing, you know, as we talked about, there's definitely, you know, parallels between the characters. Denzel Washington plays Sam Chisholm, who is kind of the Yul Brynner character. Chris Pratt plays Faraday, who's a gunslinger / gambler who's, you know, not been exactly successful, which is kind of the Steve McQueen character. Ethan Hawke plays Goodnight Robichaud, which is almost like the Robert Vaughn character. He was a famous, basically, sniper in the Confederate Army who has kind of just lost his taste for war. I mean, he's not really a coward, but he's almost shell-shocked from the experience and is kind of living off just betting on his buddy, played by Byung-Hun Lee, who plays Billy Rocks, who is the knife expert, the kind of the James Coburn character. But also Vincent D'Onofrio as Jack Horn, who's like an old Indian fighter. Manuel Garcia as Vasquez Garcia Rufio, who is the outlaw that, you know, basically is like, you know, just joining up for, because Denzel Washington, who is a basically a bounty hunter, and when he starts building this
their
team,
interaction,
he's
is
like,
just...
tell you what, you know, the pay's not good, you might die, but when this is over with, there's going to be hundreds of men still after you. And he's like, yeah, so? He's like, well, I won't be one of them. And he's like, all right, that sounds like a good thing. You're the only one of them that's found me so far, so the fact that you're not going to hunt me, that's a good thing. All right, we'll bring... And then, of course, Martin Sinsmeer, who plays Red Harvest, who is the Indian hunter who joins the group.
Yeah, and I got to say, Haley Bennett, that was Matthew's wife, Emma Cullen. I loved how they, used her character and, much of it, because, just talking about the interaction between Denzel Washington and, what was his name? It just slipped
Which
my mind.
Which guy?
When they have the encounter, we were just talking about it in the cabin.
Vasquez.
Yeah, Vasquez. It's like talking about the pay and stuff, and it's like, well, is she in? Like, oh yeah, she's in.
Yeah, because I mean, in the original movie, it was like the Mexican town folk that went to recruit. In this one, instead of being the banditos, it's this corrupt miner who basically owns this town. He's like, he basically comes in to their church when they're trying to discuss what they should do, whether they should fight or not, and it's like, I'm going to give y'all $20 a piece for your land. You can either take it, or when I come back in 7 days, I'm going to kill all of you. And ends up...
Well, he says 3 weeks originally.
Well, yeah, 3 weeks, and then he ends up coming back. But yeah, he beats up the preacher, kills Emma's husband, and then she and her friend go off to try to hire gunfighters. And when she originally meets Denzel, who has just, shot a guy in a bar, as a bounty, she... gives him the speech and everything like that, and shows him, like, he's like, here, this is everything the village has. And it's a line that was in the original movie with Yul Brynner, and he's like, I've been offered a lot for my services, but no one's ever offered me everything before. Yeah. So, intrigued him. He's like, yeah, these people are definitely in some dire straits if they're willing to give everything they have, for us to save them.
Yeah, and I mean, I that interaction was, I think quite powerful. I don't know, like it really sucked. Like I thought, Matthew's character was going to, play a bigger role in the film, because he was the first person to really stand up to Bogue.
But then again, his sacrifice, if you call it that, kind of stirred.
Yeah, well, I mean, it put all the events into motion.
Yeah.
And I got to say, dude, like that first shootout where, the Magnificent Seven, where basically, that whole, like, they shoot the 22 man dead on. So 7 versus 22. And, dude, that
scene
was
just freaking
awesome. Yeah,
when they
clear
the town before
anybody
comes in. But even, like, before that, the introduction of the characters, I liked, of course, Denzel comes into a black man in a bar in the 1800s. Probably not the safest environment, but he's such a badass. He walks in there and ends up shooting the bartender because he resists. And Chris Pass is just gambling. I mean, he's in the back chilling, and as people start trying to grind, he pulls his gun and, like, put him down, boys. Let him do his thing, and then tries, doesn't want people to know that really he is the good. He's like, I'm just trying to be a gambler. But he's like, secretly watching Denzel's back.
Yeah.
And, he notices it in the mirror and, later recruits him. But then, like, once the shooting starts, freaking Denzel kills, like, half the people. And then he's like, shoots them out, the guns out of their hands and stuff. He's, showing a lot of restraint. And he's like, somebody go get the sheriff. And they're like, yep, we're all going to get the sheriff. and freaking, Chris still sitting at the table. He's like, I forgot what the bartender's name was. Like, are you dead? He's like, pity. I just ordered a drink for that man. So Denzel gives him a drink and takes off.
Well, I mean, I like that too, you know, and Chris Pratt, you know, just him trying to be the low-key gambler, like, you know, basically, you know, everybody's running out of the bar and everything else to get away from the firefight, and he basically just scoops up the pot, puts it under his hat, and, you know, proceeds to walk away with a bottle of, I assume is probably whiskey.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where we get the encounter with the two guys that decide that they're going to rob him or whatever. And
yeah,
we get to learn that he's also a bit of a magician. Fuck. Magician.
Yeah. But yeah, he's like, if you're going to kill me, let me show you a trick first. He's like, I'm very good. I didn't cheat you. Let me show you this. And he's like, first he pulls out the card and like, this is your card. And they're like, no, that's not our card. You suck. He's like, wait a minute. And this pulls the card out of midair and it's their card. And they're like, holy crap. Well, you just distract him and pulls a gun out of his back and shoots one in the head, shoots the other one's ear off, and he's like, I didn't want to kill him, but you shouldn't have touched my guns. And you never really know what his backstory is of why he is like I said, he's lost everything, and Denzel ends up buying his horse back from him that he lost gambling, and he's like, all right, you know, you owe me your services for buying your horse, so you know, you ride with us until you pay this off, you know, we're gonna, you know, if you survive. But you know, even after, you know, Denzel tells him, like, you know, you're paid up. You don't owe me anything, man. If you want to go, you go. And he's like, nah, I'm here. Now you owe me something. You owe me cover, you know, in the middle of that. And so you never know why he's such, because he tries not to care, but obviously he cares, or he would have turned tail at any point. You know, he was the one that was like, you know, even when, you know, Ethan Hawke's character was kind of trying to train the villagers, even though he was like, you know, Chris knew he was kind of scared shitless, and he goes up there and gives his whole big speech and kind of, you know, pours him on. And
it's the origin of the officer speech.
Yeah. And even the villagers trying to shoot, you know, they're like horrible. He's like, you know, statistically, y'all should have hit something by accident.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, they had what? Probably 15, 20 villagers, you know, behind the freaking
fire
line. And like, and every one of them
every
missed.
Single one of them missed.
And notice, none of them even hit the broadside of the barn either.
Yeah. Oh.
So I was looking at the silhouettes that they had created, and then I was like, there's a barn back there, and I'm like looking off in the distance to see if there's like any kind of holes or anything. Like,
yeah, literally could not send this outside of a barn. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that whole recruiting mission, too, at the start with, you know, of them finding everybody. Yeah, they split up, and Chris and one of the villagers goes off to find Goodnight, and he runs into him and Billy basically, you know, hustling town folk on, you know, whatever, quick draw competitions. And then, of course, Denzel and all of them go off and find Vasquez, which we already talked about. But then when they come back together, you know, Chris Pratt's like, oh, great, we have a Mexican. Yes. Oh, and then, like, when they go to find, try to get Jack Horn, which is Vincent D'Onofrio's character, which he was like this badass tracker, hunter, ex-Indian fighter.
Dude, he's just, all right, he's a bear of a man. Yes.
Like, and these two guys like, oh, look, we got his rifle. We killed him because, you know, there was a bounty on his head. You know, we're going to be famous. We're the only people that killed Jack Horn. And the rest of the guys are sitting there like, yeah, y'all killed Jack Horn. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden, like, a hatchet comes out of nowhere, hits one of the guys. And the other guy, dude, he just basically just beats him to death with his bare hands. And then looks at the group and he's like, I was just getting, they tried to kill me. I was just getting back what they stole. You know, it's perfectly legal. And they're all like, hey, we got no problem with this. And he just walks off, and freaking Chris Pratt's like, I do believe that bear was wearing man clothes.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, his character is just, I mean, just the brute strength. But, I mean, it's exactly what you would expect out of, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, just big ass burly, like, will destroy
Biggest
you with
shit,
his bare
bro.
Hand. But, you know, at the same time, it's got, you know, the heart of gold. You
yeah,
know?
He was like a very religious person, you know, and was, you know, constantly talking about, you know, God and all this other stuff. So and then, you know, taking care of the kids and the town folk when they do get to the town. Like I said, he was one of those guys that's like, I'm big as shit, bro, but, you know, I'm still a good man. And, you know, and almost remind me almost of, you know, Uncle Jesse from Dukes of Hazzard.
Like, I think out of just about anybody, it was John Horn. That character is probably one of the most intimidating.
Like, just that high-pitched voice with that giant man with that just high-pitched, raspy voice.
I don't know. That's one man that I'm just like, nope, I'm going to opt out of, because it don't matter if he's got a gun, a weapon, or not. Like
he's definitely got the old man strength.
Oh, but I we talked about it a little bit earlier, though, but, you know, freaking Billy Rock's character, dude, just the badassery with the knives, man.
Yes.
Like, that's, like, you know, going back to them trying to train the villagers, and, you know, there's a silhouette on, you know, either side.
Yeah, he's got three, like dummies set up.
He's like, come on, you know, it's really easy. Just, you know, watch what I do, you know, just, you
know. He just shreds them.
Well, he shreds them, but that initial just, you know, the two flicks, and it's, you know, dead on, like, you know, center mass. I'm just like, that's bad.
And all the villagers are like, nope, and they just drop their knives, walk away. They're like, no, we're not working with this guy. He's too good. And that's, and like when you first meet that character too, it was kind of cool because it was almost a parallel of the scene in the original when they first meet Britt. That, you know, someone trans him to, he says he's faster with a knife than a gun, and someone, you know, challenged him. Well, in this one, they're both with guns and doing a quick draw competition, trying to shoot like a bottle that's next to the person to see who hit it first. Well, the guy, like no, everyone's like, no, you lost. He's like, oh, I won. I want a rematch. Let's do it for real. So Billy's like, takes his gun belt off, takes his hat off, and stands there, no weapons. And then when the guy says draw, he pulls a knife out of his hair and nails the guy right in the neck. It was, like I said, it was such, like, badassery.
Yeah.
He was like a cowboy ninja.
Yeah. I was just like, holy shit.
Yeah, I need to get a dartboard, work on my knife skills, man. I'm slacking. Yeah. You never got to reload a knife. I think I heard that in some movie somewhere. Oh, yeah. But yeah, Fagin, the bad guy of this too, Peter Skarsgård, playing Bartholomew Bogue, such a good job of playing an evil bastard. I mean, he was just like disgustingly evil. Not just corrupt, I mean, just straight up freaking evil.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, like when they first, you know, arrive into town, and, you know, after the gunfight, and they're like, all right, call out your sheriff. And, you know, the sheriff comes out there, you know, who is on Bogue's payroll along with like five other henchmen. And, you know, it's basically like,
yeah, he's got a bunch of paid security, you know, they're carrying badges, but they're really, you know, just paid henchmen.
And, you know, it's like, that's a lot of deputies for such a small town, don't you think, sheriff? And
because the sheriff really has, like, he's like, if I resist, I'm going to die. So, like, I really have no, yeah. And when the gunfight starts, the sheriff goes, hides under the,
yeah, well, I mean, I think that was great, like, foreshadowing of, you know, just, you know, I don't know how selfish, you know, that, you know, the sheriff really is. I mean, he's so cowardly that, you know, and, you know, I kind of think, you know, back to modern times a little bit, like, man, like, you know, how many people would take that path of, you know, resistance?
Yeah,
you know, there's not that loyalty that, no, I'd rather die for my honor than, you know, just be a pawn and, you know, completely sell myself out.
Because, yeah, he wasn't one of Bogue's, like, you know, hired guns that he brought in. He was the town sheriff originally, but, you know, money and guns, you know, basically took his soul. And the coward always gets it in the end.
Yeah. And he got it.
Yeah, because they kill pretty much every one of Bogue's men in the town and then send the sheriff to give Bogue the bad news, which, you know, as they always say, don't kill the messenger. They killed the messenger.
Yeah. Holy crap. And, you know, freaking, I don't know. I don't want to really give away too much, but, dude, Chris Pratt, like, once they pull out the Gatling gun and they, you know, start the assault with the Gatling gun, and, you know, Chris Pratt, you know, and his dying moments, just freaking, you know,
so, yeah,
trying to light the cigar, and, you know, just to have Bogue light it.
I know when Bogue was one of his men.
Or one of his men, yeah. And, you know, just.
Yeah, he, you know, he gets all shot up, and he's, you know, knows he's going to die, pulls out a cigar, because he's a man, and but he can't get the get it lit. So, you know, one of the guys, you know, the men they've been fighting kind of start to respect what these guys have done. You know, seven men turned a village into an army and took down, you know, vastly outnumbered
and outtrained.
Yeah,
like,
and so he lights his cigar for him, and then he kind of falls down like you think he's dead, but nope, pulling out the dynamite. Yippee-ki-yay.
But, I mean, some of the booby traps and everything else that they use to outfit the town, I mean, just freaking awesome. I mean, from, you know, not only a, you know, a battle plan standpoint, but just, like, I don't know. It was just really cool watching everybody come together and like, well, you know, they're going to be forced to attack from the south. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to dig trenches here, bury dynamite. We're going to...
And like, yeah, other trenches. So when they go over, we jump up and kill them from behind. And yeah,
you know, the
like,
church that they had burned down, they're like, hey, can we still get in the steeple? So they create, you know, a freaking sniping nest. And, you know, just so much badassery. Like,
and Ethan Hawke's character, too, because there's... There's a scene in both movies where it's like the night before the great battle and just everybody's kind of trying to prepare in their own way. And he chickens out. He leaves, you know, everybody behind. And, you know, the girl says, like, I'll take his spot, yeah. But once the shit really hits the fan, you know, he comes back, you know, blazing rifles, taking everybody out. You know, he finally, you know, found his courage.
Which was, you know, it was kind of weird, you know, him actually being, you know, was it, I forgot which side of the war he was on.
Oh, he was a Confederate.
So, you know, he was a Confederate sniper. So he was the one that actually had training and battle experience. And, you know, he was the one that I guess, you know, shit just, you know, I don't want to relive the torment I've already been through. I'm out. Like,
yeah, it's like Robert Vaughn's character says in the first movie. It's kind of, he's like, it's kind of stupid that a deserter is hiding in the middle of a battlefield. That was his thing, because he was like, you know, basically on the roam because he was, I guess, a deserter or something like that, even though, but, you know, that wasn't Ethan Hawke. His character, Goodnight, you know, served distinguishedly, you know, was like probably one of the highest, like, decorated guy. You know, they built up this whole thing of his performance in the war, but it was just one of those guys that, like, you know, just had enough of the killing. He's like, if I, you know, go back to killing, I'm going to die in a horrible way. And he's like, just couldn't deal with the trail of bodies he had left behind anymore. And I mean, you see that in anyone who's gone to war. I mean, he had almost had a PTSD before they knew what PTSD was, you know, back in, you know, the West and stuff. But, you know, when it came down to, you know, yeah, at first he has that kind of break of will, but then, you know, his conscience gets the better of him. He's like, I can't leave my friends. I can't leave my duty. And comes back to live or die with the rest of them. Which, him coming all the way back to the town and telling them that the guy had a Gatling gun might not have been the best tactical decision. I mean, shouldn't you just took out the Gatling gun? You are a sniper. Stay outside the village. Take out that Gatling gun crew. Don't just come back to get killed.
Yeah, dude, that freaking Gatling gun was just nasty. Like...
But yeah,
I think if there was a weapon, you know, back in the 1800s, and this is set, like, that's a weapon to fear.
Yeah, I mean, that was the weapon of mass destruction of the day. And I mean, it's still such a badass. I mean, we still see use that, I mean, modern miniguns, freaking modern Gatling guns on big, I mean, the functionality, I mean, the technology's kind of gone up, but it's still, like, basically functions the same way. I mean, that's probably one of the most iconic, you know, advancements in firearms is the Gatling gun model. I mean, it's was huge leap forward in technology for the day and still continues to be. But yeah, when all that shit starts going down and him and Billy get into the church and are defending Chris Pratt as Faraday makes his charge on the Gatling gun, just popping off everybody that's chasing him. I mean, that was just just badass.
Yeah. Which, I don't know, man. You know, freaking Emma and, you know, her rifle skills were
yeah,
nothing
she,
to bat
she
an
stepped
eye
up.
At.
She definitely turned into the, you know, the local badass.
Like, you know, the whole part where, you know, Chris Pratt, you know, finds her, you know, off in the distance, you know, and they, you know, have their interaction, you know, just watching her shoot, I was just like, damn.
Yeah. Like, and I'll tell you, after this watching this movie, I so want to shoot Western style. Like, I don't know. I probably spent like a couple hours on YouTube watching freaking Western shooting competition videos. I'm just like, I've got to get me a six shooter after this. I'm like, I want to be a cowboy now.
Yeah.
On a steel horse I ride.
After October wraps up in November, you're like, hey, I got my Netherworld check. I'm full cowboy.
Yeah.
like
maybe one. I don't know if I can afford two at once. But
you're gonna be like,
I'll get one and then save up for my second one.
So I'm come in. There's gonna be a freaking horse in the backyard. Like, when did we get a horse? Oh, you know, cowboy gotta have horse.
Oh,
good times. But yeah, man,
really
I
really big dog. I don't know if I can afford a horse, but get like a greyhound. Not a greyhound. Was it the like Scooby Doo dog?
Oh, Great Dane.
Yeah, get a Great Dane, put a saddle on him. Oh.
But yeah, I got to say, man, like, you know, as I was stating earlier, like, I didn't know if I was going to like or hate the film. But I got to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It kept to the theme of the original, but changed up enough where this is a standalone movie. I mean, it may have the same name, but to me, this looked like an original idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were, like you said, there were so many parallels, but there was enough of a difference. And I don't know. I mean, I try to read more, you know, into things. And, you know, I think that even though this is set in the 1800s, that there's a lot of things that, you know, apply to society today. And, you know, that's one of the things that really helps, you know, me mentally get involved, you know, in a movie that I can relate and I can, you know, I start to question things within myself and, well, you know, if this was happening or whatever, what would my actions be?
Yeah, because, I mean, there's still modern-day heroics and stuff, and the true measure of a man, whether it be law enforcement, firefighter, first responder, military, is when the shit hits the fan and people are running from the danger. It's the real, and I say men generically, but men, women, everybody who are the ones that are running toward the dangers. Those are the modern day cowboys, the modern day American heroes.
I mean, that should have been a closing statement. Shit.
Regulate us. Yeah. Mount up.
Oh.
So as we're kind of wrapping up, do you have a particular favorite character in both either or either movie or a particular scene that stands out to you?
I think the scene with Red Harvest and, you know, freaking Sam in the new movie where they have their first interaction.
Yeah.
So it's the day before the big battle and you have this warrior Indian, you know, out scoping who, you know, is just... You know, apparently, you know, come across a kill or, you know, made a, you know,
yeah,
kill
and, some,
you know,
like
comes
Indians
across this, you know,
or
group of white men and, you know, and it's alluded, you know, Denzel Washington's character basically was, you know, yes, I'm, you know, an Indian peacekeeper and, you know, all this other stuff.
Yeah, he's the only one that spoke Comanche. He had basically been a lawman and a bounty hunter and
but their
and
engagement
else.
When everybody else is like, oh shit, where there's one, there's always more and you're yeah,
especially
expecting
Jack,
like, you know,
he's an old Indian fighter.
A straight up, you know, like cowboys versus Indian and, you know, Denzel, you know, takes off his guns and everything, walks out there and, you know, and Red Harvest freaking gets off his horse and throws his, you know, kill on the ground and, you know, pulls out the heart. And, you know, they have that moment there where it's like, you know, almost a symbol of peace where it's, you know,
yeah.
All right, white man, Indian, you know, we're feasting off the same meal. We're now, you know, kind of yeah. together as one.
And even that little speech they have before that, because he walks up and he asks him, he's like, hey, you know, where's your the rest of your people? And he's like, well, the village elders told me that I go a different path from everyone else. And he's like, well, we're fixing to go do some
stuff.
Yeah. And he's like, all right, I'm in. And hands him the heart, which is like, you know, the warrior's greeting. You know, you eat the heart of your kill. And he calls it the Red Harvest, which that's kind of his name as well. And he's like, all right, I'm in. But then like the interactions with him and Jack Horn too. I love like, cause later on, like the eve of the battle, they're all just kind of like saying their, you know, what their final things on their mind is. And he just goes, I'm hungry. And they're like, what?
What? You speak English?
He's like, yeah, a little. And like walks on and Jack's like, no, wait, come on back here. We got a lot to talk about now.
Like, I don't know. To me, that was just one of those moments that, you know, just I think truly defined the essence of what yeah. I was looking for out of this movie.
I think for me, like I said, because they're almost pretty much the same character, freaking Steve McQueen's character and Chris Pratt's character of Faraday, they were the lightheartedness of the group. Like they were almost the heart of the team, and they kind of, yeah, these men are facing almost certain death, but they never acted like this shit was any kind of danger. They kept everybody a little bit lighthearted and added that, you know, because this could have been a very serious movie in both cases.
Yes.
But that little bit of levity just kind of to break up the stress here and there, you know, made it an even better movie.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing about this movie is, you know, when shit hits the fan, you truly feel like, oh, shit hit the fan, you know? Yeah. So the way that, you know, everybody does such a phenomenal job in, you know, like you said, this could have been a very serious, you know, almost a Debbie Downer of a film, yeah. You know, but because of everybody's acting, it, you know, it was almost like a roller coaster, you yeah. know, because there were moments that's like, oh, this is funny. There's moments where it's like, oh, that's badass. And there's moments like, oh, fuck. Like,
yeah, I mean, even if you go back to Antoine's earlier work of Training Day, Training Day, I mean, it had its light moments, but that was a dark movie at times. And this one never got that dark. Even in the darkest moments, there were still little cool, like, yeah, you know, go team moments.
But, I think the camaraderie here yeah. is one of the things that I think really helped this film. And I don't know. I mean, this is a movie that I thoroughly enjoyed. You know, I think the 1960 version, you know, was a little bit dated for me. You know, I didn't necessarily get exposed to it, you know, the way that you did. But, you know, so I could relate to the newer film quite a bit more because, yeah. you know, I'm looking at it, you know, just from, I try to never go into a movie just like, oh, I'm going to sit down and watch a movie. Like, it's always like, what is the director or, you know, this particular actor, what are they really trying to portray here? So I'm always looking for a little bit more depth and meaning behind stuff. And I think that's one of the reasons I love the movie so much.
Yeah, I just kept waiting for Sam Chisholm to say, King Kong ain't got shit on me. It was the Training Day reunion film. You got Antoine, you got Denzel, you got Ethan Hawke. It's like a weird reunion film.
Absolutely. All right.
And also, as we're kind of wrapping up, any final thoughts on the cigar here?
Man, this has been a damn good cigar. I mean, The peppery taste are, you know, what I'm going to call pepper. You know, it's got that spice to it that I love so much when I'm smoking a cigar is, you know, this is my new go-to, hands down. Like, you know.
CAO, like, has kind of been, yeah, I kind of got about, yeah, like I said, I'm always trying new stuff just so we have something to talk about on the show. But as far as my go-to everyday smokes, when I don't want to think about it, I just want to get something I know I like. It's usually either Punch Signature Series, something from CAO, usually the Flathead, or one of the Rockies. This may kind of go into my stable of CAO cigars, because like I said, I love the Flathead, but this is a damn good cigar.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the Flathead is a damn good cigar. In fact, I had one yesterday.
They can almost tend to be a little bit of a powerhouse at time. It's not one I like to smoke on an empty stomach. Especially if you get the bigger one, like the 770, yeah. That thing will put you down if you don't have like a solid base. you're not using the stoke strong. This one, it's strong, but it's not overpoweringly strong.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe that's the thing is, you know, it's very well balanced, but it's complex. But to me, it has a little bit more of that spice than what I think the Flathead has, and that's one of the things that I really like, you know. I'll smoke the, you know, freaking Diamond Crown Julius Caesar because I like that, you know, the initial spice and everything that cigar has. And, you know.
This definitely backs up the power with flavor and nuances.
Yes.
It may be close to full strength, but it's definitely full flavor.
But, I you know. CAO hit it out of the ballpark with this cigar. Like, I'd be curious to try some of the other sizes to see how they compare because, You know, a lot of times, like, you can have, you know, the same filler, binder, whole nine yeah. yards, but the size, you know.
Yeah,
and
I do want to try that Boss torpedo. And that's the thing, like, in a world where the 660 has become, like, the norm now, I kind of miss smoking a 56, 54 ring gauge. I mean, this is, it's almost the, the good mouthfeel. It's not, like, too big.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something you can just kind of hold and smoke and.
I mean, it's definitely more comfortable.
Yeah.
I like this cigar, too, because, you know, you buy something like the Flathead, and especially if you get in a 60 ring gauge, you know, we've talked about it many times before. Oftentimes, it's hard to find the right kind of cutter, you know.
Big box press, you got to have a punch for it. It's like, I can't fit it in my Zycar.
You know, I either do the V-cut or, you know, I'll do the punch on it or whatever. But, you know, this right here, regardless of the style punch or, you know, or the cutter, you're probably going to be okay, you know, whereas unless you're a, you know, cigar guru who just likes toys the way that we like toys.
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, shiny.
Yeah, I didn't realize how many lighters and cutters we have until we did that segment with Corey a couple weeks ago, and we pulled out all our gear so he could see it, and we're like, we got a lot of shit.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, hell, we've almost got as many ashtrays as we have lighters now. It's just...
But that's crucial, though.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, when you have
neither toys,
you know, when we have 6-8 people over that are all smoking cigars, there's nothing more annoying to me than not having a place to rest my cigars.
Yeah, or having
so,
to, like, you know, pass an ashtray back and forth because you're on a big
that,
table,
or it gets, you know, full and everything. So, you know what? It just makes creature comforts.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
This is how it's gonna be. This is what you think of me. It's going down like I told you. This is how it's gonna be. I'll be the last man standing here. I'm not going anywhere. It's going down like I told you. I'll be the last man standing here.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back to the podcast. It's Beer 30. So what are we drinking this week, Brad?
Well, this week we're enjoying another treat by Jekyll Brewing out of Alpharetta, Georgia, called Seven Bridges. And this is their Oktoberfest style lager.
Yeah, since we are dead center in the middle of October, be nice, Oktoberfest beer, it's a pretty much a like true lager, which yeah, don't hadn't drank a lot of these lately, but it's a according to them, you know, full bodied, sweet and bready in a Marzen style fashion.
Yeah, I mean this is much more, you know, to your traditional style lagers. You know, this beer comes in, you know, I don't know. I mean it's. It's relatively on the dark side, I guess. You know, it's about a 5.3% ABV. And I got to say, as far as the flavor and everything else goes, I mean, you know, even though the ABV is relatively, you know, it's not as high gravity as a lot of stuff we drink, it very much still feels full-bodied.
Well, that's the thing with, like, an Oktoberfest-style beer. I mean, it's... You don't really want a high alcohol content because if you're going to be sitting around at a party, you know, drinking steins of this all day with your other buddies pretending to be German, you want to have a beer that you can go full session. Yeah, you want to have more than three and not be passed out under your table with your Lederhosen. You want something you can drink all night without getting too stupid.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, this is the It's the first time I've had this beer, so I don't know if this is a annual release for Jekyll or not. But
it's on their seasonal releases page, not their limited edition. So this must be something that, like I said, it's a yearly thing they produce, or they're planning to produce, one or the other.
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm really digging it. You know, that's kind of been the thing about, you know, Jekyll. I mean, even with their freaking what was it? The Habanero Pineapple IPA that they had. Like, even not being an IPA fan, I enjoyed that. So I'm really digging, you know, what Jekyll's been putting out. It's awesome too that they're, you know, local in the Alpharetta area for folks that, you know, are in Georgia, may know that city.
Yeah, if you are in the area, I suggest definitely stopping by and taking the tour, because they do they have it's kind of a party atmosphere. You go there, they have a little bar set up for your sampling, and like I said, they've got some games, some ping pong, some giant Jenga made out of like 2x4s, and on the weekends they normally put on like a little bit of a bigger party, because I know they've had some kind of like cigar tents down there, and like some bands play and stuff on the weekend. So yeah. And they're open like pretty much 7 days a week. So if you don't want to go to the Saturday big tours, you know, come during the week after work, you have yourself a beer.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoy doing their tour. But I don't know. I mean, for me, I'm at a solid 4.5 on this beer.
Yeah, it's pretty, like I said, this is probably the most beer-like beer we've had so far. You know, we tend to get some dark stuff and some strange stuff. This is the most like regular everyday drinking beer that I think we've had on the show,
which I think is a good thing, because it's not so obscure that it's difficult to find. So,
and like I said, it's Oktoberfest, so stock up now.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, it says on the bottle, you know, this is perfect beer for, you know, when the crisp air starts coming down Seven Bridges Road. I mean, you know, it's already started coming down the road that we're on, so I really enjoyed this time of year. Time for some chili, some fire pits, and...
As soon as I start having free time again, we need to do that.
Yeah, and...
Bring up the fire pit, some chili, and some beers.
Absolutely, man. All right, any further thoughts?
I'm going to have another.
Sweet. All right, stay tuned for the next segment.
Welcome to Myobi Defend Your Childhood, the podcast where every week we put a little bit of your past on trial. Wait, you don't know who we are? Well, fine. First, we take a movie that you like. You know the ones. The ones the buses always had on field trips.
We got a real jam going down. Welcome to the Space Jam.
The afternoon animated show tie-in.
Or rewrite history, DuckTales.
Woo! Or the ones your parents didn't want you to see, but you watched at a sleepover. So that's the game. The movies are 10 years old and the defendant hasn't seen them in 5. Then
we're here to talk about The Sandlot. When I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to play with the other children, so this is how I learned human interaction.
Ask them what they think.
Obviously, I remembered your wigs, because as soon as my parents found out that I was deathly afraid of parasites, they were like, let's show her Rathacon.
So, in the end, does your past hold up? Can you defend your childhood? Tune in every Thursday to find out.
And welcome back. It's time for science.
Man, I feel like we haven't done a science like...
Yeah, I know. We've had like real scientists and interviews and everything else for the last couple weeks. So it's been a while since I've had to delve into the world of science. Do you miss your education? Do you feel like you've left, you know?
No, see, you know, because we've actually interviewed real scientists and talked to people that actually knew what they were talking about. Like my...
Yeah, you probably learned a lot more in the last couple weeks than you do from my ranting. Since we are in October and things are, you know, got a good science article for you, something creepy up front. Creepy clowns.
Man, what the hell is with... Like, my social media has been blowing up with clowns. Like, you know, apparently, like, I was, you know, at a local store the other day looking at firearms, and there were, like, 4 people at the counter all talking about, like, you know, half the kids at a high school didn't go to school today because, you know, there was a clown threat and
you can't,
you know,
buy
they were
creepy
scared
clown targets
and,
if you just want to practice.
You know, all kinds of stuff. So I need to understand what the hell is it about these clowns that's got everybody in an uproar.
Well, that's one of the things, because I had a discussion the other night talking about the psychology of fear. Cause as a haunted, there are tricks and stuff to scaring people. It's not just jumping out and boo. There's ways to use psychology. Like one of my favorite things is to give someone the illusion of safety and then taking it away. Like, you know, maybe, oh, everything's all right. I'm nice. And no, I'm not, you know, or, you know, I got this rope in front of me that keeps me from attacking you. And then all of a sudden the rope's gone and I'm like in your face. It's that, you know, screwing with people's minds a little bit. And, you know, Frank T. McAndrew, released a paper called On the Nature of Creepiness, basically where he wanted to do a study of why people are freaked out by clowns. And apparently this is nothing new. There's been creepy clowns forever. And even with these creepy clown sightings we're having now, there was a rash of them back in the 80s in Boston. And a writer, Lauren Coleman, who is a cryptozoologist, kind of racked it up most to like mass hysteria, where there's no real determination of how many of these stories are real, but they kind of are becoming real because, you know, it's people like, oh, there's creepy clowns. So that tree I just drove by, I thought that was a clown, you know, it's, or people making, you know, false statements or whatever. But in his study, you know, he had, you know, 1,341 volunteers, and basically it filled out, it was a survey study, and it was, like I said, it was published in New Ideas on Psychology. Basically, they had a survey that had basically rated 44 behaviors that people would find, you know, how creepy they found those 44 behaviors, a rating of 21 occupations in their like level of creepiness, had people list two creepy hobbies and had see how much people agreed to 15 statements on creepiness. And the results of it, of course, the number one creepy occupation was clowns.
Which is, you know, kind of, you know, odd in a sense. I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe because I never really had a whole lot of exposure to clowns, but, you know, clowns were one of those things that, you know, terrified me. I mean, even after watching, you know, Stephen King's It back in the day and Pennywise, like...
And that's one of the things they've said has kind of led to that, is because you got John Wayne Gacy killing people dressed up as a clown in the 70s, and then Hollywood perpetuated that with stuff like Stephen King's It, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. You know, Hollywood made a big deal of clowns being creepy. But even other studies like that, like, they've found out that kids don't really like... A vast majority of kids don't really like clowns, and how some hospitals decorate their children's wards with clowns and stuff actually has the opposite effect of making it it actually increases some stress levels. But according to the study, the main things they found out, it wasn't just like physical characteristics. The main things people marked as what they found creepy was their unpredictability, their nonverbal behavior, and unpredictable eye contact. So basically what it came down to is, you've heard of the fight or flight response.
Yep.
Well, when you're dealing with something that is unpredictable, innate, like unpredictable. So you can't tell if it's a threat.
Quick, Joe mispronounced the word. Everybody take a drink.
Yeah. Mouse dry. I can't pronounce that. But yeah, basically your natural reaction to fight or flight is kind of paused by this, because it's a clown. It looks friendly. It's got a big smile on his face. But since you're not seeing its real face, and you don't know its real intentions, you don't know if it's going to tell you a joke or stab you in the heart, it overrides that sense of fight or flight. So you're just kind of like locked up in fear because you don't know how to react to the situation. And that's what makes clowns creepy, is because you can't tell if it wants to hurt you or be your friend.
I guess I kind of see it. I don't know. I mean...
It kind of leads like, you know, just uncertainty of it all. Cause you don't know, you know, your defenses don't know if they need to go up or down. And it's kind of, you know, puts you into full lockdown when you're dealing with something that you don't know the threat level or not.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think my instinct is going to be, you invade my personal space, and the, you know, first sign of uncomfort or, you know, whatever, it's going to be, you know, fight instinct's going to kick in, and whatever happens, don't be a dumbass and approach me like, you know, without some understanding. Or, like, just as unpredictable as you may be as a clown, I'm that unpredictable as a human.
And like I said, I've even seen that, you know, myself trying to scare people. I can be dressed as like a big ass monster, but if I come at somebody with a giant grin on my face, like I'm having a good time, that freaks people out more than being threatening. Well,
I mean, I think it's the psychotic, and that's what it
like
does.
Like if I'm being threatening, that scares some people, but if I'm looking threatening and also being friendly at the same time, that freaks people out. it's like, well, you know, old saying, you know, smile if you want people to think you're up to something. And I think that kind of translates into the clown fear.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I've kind of been wondering, you know, I mean, I know that I've read some stuff on, you know, news articles and stuff about, you know, clowns appearing out of the woods trying to grab kids or whatever. Like, you know, if you're trying to cross some boundaries like that, like, don't be surprised if you end up with, you know, a freaking bullet in you. But, you know, by and large, I wonder, like, how much of this is, you know, like, Stephen King's got the remake of It happening in 2017.
Yeah,
so,
some kind of
stealth
marketing campaign,
you know,
for
is
something.
This, you know, almost like we saw with the Deadpool, you know, marketing campaign where, like, you have all this viral shit. Or, you know, the damn robots that people were mistaking as bombs?
Oh, Aqua Teen Hunger Force thing.
Yes.
And that's another thing. This could have started off as some kind of viral marketing campaign, and it's generated like copycats and just, you know. So, and like I said, if you jump on YouTube, there's so many like creepy clown prank videos. And I swear all these have to be filmed somewhere where there's not a lot of people carrying guns because, yeah, like.
Well, I mean.
Clown comes at me with a machete. He's getting double tapped.
I mean, I almost wonder, you know, how much of this is staged. Like, you know, I've seen so many, like, it seems to be the new hit on YouTube is, you know, people's reaction, whether it be
a lot of those clown videos, they're not filmed in the U.S. They're not speaking English half the time. So it's like, yeah, it's probably a country where firearm concealed carry is not very big.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, kind of to my point, it's. You know, I, in fact, I was watching, you know, this thing where a guy's in a clown mask and jumps out behind a corner and, you know, gets confronted and the guy smashes.
Dude, hits him with a
but
bottle.
You know what? Like, I got to call bullshit on that because
no one else is reacting.
Well, not only is nobody else reacting, but, you know, that camera and where this is shot is probably a good 20, 30 feet away. You don't get that kind of sound quality and audio quality from cell phone footage or anything else without having some kind of production value there.
Somebody has to be mic'd up.
So, you know, like, I almost wonder if people see stuff like that and they're not, you know, necessarily looking at it from a technical standpoint and saying, well, I know if I record something from 50 feet away on my cell phone video, what's that going to sound like? Yes, cell phone video has, you know, come a long way. You know, the mics on cell phones have gotten slightly better, but they don't sound like, you know, oh, everything's normalized. The audio is absolutely perfectly crystal clear and everything to that extent. Like, that's not raw cell phone footage you're seeing there.
And on to another story. Recently, there was I think it's called the Clean Power plan or something that the government tried to implement, wanting us to decrease use of coal and increase more renewable energy by 2030. So I was reading an article about, you know, because people tout these different green energies like wind farms. And I was looking into like how much it would take to actually go completely dependent on something like wind power. Because currently 67% of our energy comes from fossil fuel, 20% from nuclear power, and, you know, 6 from hydro and 7 from other sources. And recently there was a study to answer this question. And apparently we use 4.082 billion megawatt hours annually in the U.S. So to generate that much power with something like wind would take 583,000 turbines. Now, each turbine requires nearly an acre of land, so basically, it would take a spot of land the size of Rhode Island. We would have to, like, pretty much lose a state to go full wind.
Well, and I mean, you know, I'm not going to try to get into the political side of things, you know. Do I think that we should be doing... Sure, yeah, whatever, you know. But then again, like, I think about how big the world is, how big the universe is, and... do we really have the propensity to, you know, affect as much change as what we're being touted we are creating? Probably not. In the grand scheme of things, we're peons in the universe. Yeah. So, you know, but, you know, to the other effect, like, I've seen so many, like, you know, people come out and say that, you know, you can't live near a wind farm. You know, then, you know, the impact that it takes an acre of land, so you're, you know, having to essentially like clear cut. Then you're also, you know, like there was, you know,
birds and everything else.
Birds and everything to that extent, like, you know.
Plus, really, they're pretty much like 40% efficient. That's like, yeah, it's, you lose a lot of energy as well with these things. And like anything like that, even solar power takes up a lot of land. It also increases heat in the local area, apparently. So, you know, some people think that, you know, there's a magic bullet, that, you know, there's something we can do to completely go off the grid, but it's not a perfect solution. There's, you know, I mean, you can increase nuclear, something like that. That's but in this, nuclear is probably like one of the best options, but in today's terrorism rich environment, you know, that's a, security becomes an issue at that point, because I mean, if someone pulled a 9/11, flew a plane into a nuclear silo, that's gonna be some bad shit.
Yeah, but then again, if you've got an entire power grid operating on, you know, this wind farm, guess what I'm going to target?
Yeah, and
you know, and if
wind doesn't blow all the time, it's not a constant source of energy. Oh.
Well, I mean, and I think that's the reason that they're having to make them, you know, so much higher and everything else. That way they have the altitude. So even though, you know, the wind on the surface may not be great, you know, there's still enough, you know, wind. I mean, there's always constant motion within the atmosphere. But I don't know. You know, do I think it's a perfect solution? Absolutely not. Do I think that, you know, we should just sit around and do nothing? No, but, you know, yeah, like, I would really like to
find... It's not a 100% solution. It might, should, could be part of a coalition of things.
You know, I mean, unfortunately, like, so much stuff gets politicized. So yeah. I would like to, you know what, have private industry go out there. You know, fuck the EPA and the government and everything else. Have independent scientists who, you know, aren't looking for a grant or, you know.
I mean, it's worked for the space industry. I mean, they mostly privatized that. And, like, you know, some of these civilian space programs are starting to show, you know, decent results.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, you remove all the bureaucratic government BS out of it and let, you know, a private industry in, then chances are you're going to get a lot less biased results, because you don't have lifelong politicians banking on, you know, putting a particular spin and a success. And I don't know. I just don't think that, you know, government intervention is, you know, good in all assets. I'm definitely not a fan of Big Brother. So
and that's the thing too. A lot of these people that are very green people don't think beyond what they're doing, because they're like, oh, I drive this electric car, this Leaf, so I'm not polluting the environment. Guess what? The electricity that powers your car has to come from somewhere, and 67% of it's coming from fossil fuels. So, yeah, there's still pollution going into the environment, even though you're driving a freaking electric car.
I mean, you've still got rubber on the wheels. Yeah. You've still got, you know...
Electricity is not magical. It comes from somewhere. unless you start driving a solar car, which those... I don't think that's a viable option anyone's come up with yet. Yeah, you're still... polluting.
You know, once again, you know, do I think there's a
plus those batteries when those cars eventually end up in a junkyard are a huge biohazard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, I just feel like we get spoon-fed so much stuff from I don't care what political source or where you get your news or whatever, like somebody's got a spin and an idea that they want you to believe in, and I don't know, I want to find the most independent and non-politically biased, you know, solution. And what is that? I don't know. I don't have all the answers.
Gonna go off the grid, man. Live in a cabin in the woods with my shotgun and my dog until kids get off my land.
You know, ideally, like that would almost be a viable solution, right? You know, teach people to live off of the land and, you know, oh, look, I don't have to commute. I don't have to do this. Oh, my cost of living, because I'm not trying to, you know, have a fancy house, all this other shit. Like, you know, I don't know. You know,
I got another kind of in medical news, interesting thing I came across. The first child born of three parents recently happened in Mexico, because apparently this procedure is not yet legalized in the U.S. But normally, for anyone who failed science in high school, you're a combination of half your mother's chromosomes and half your father's chromosomes, and that gets you. Well, there's certain diseases, this one specifically was, I think it's called Lee syndrome, where basically either the mother or the father has the mother in this case was a carrier of the disease. She didn't suffer from the disease, but so she could not have children because it's a, she had already had two kids that she had lost to this disease. And the cells that carry that disease is the mitochondrial DNA, which when you're talking about the egg, there's the nucleus of the egg, and then there's the rest. If you're looking at if you're looking at a chicken egg, the yellow is the nucleus, the white is everything else. So, and the everything else is where the disease is. So what scientists have done is basically they combined the nucleus from the mother's egg and the rest of the egg from a donor, and then fertilized it with the father. So now this baby has a combination of all three DNAs, but checking its cells, where normally there has to be 18% of this disease in the mitochondrial DNA for it to be effect, this kid's only got one. And from all tests and things, not going to suffer from this. So it's something that can definitely help people that suffer from this disease, have children that otherwise they could not have. And also prevent him future, when this kid grows up, from passing that on to, his children.
That's kind of interesting. That was a different direction than I thought this was going altogether. So that's pretty awesome.
We'll end on something, happy, New life in the universe,
Yay!
After we took you down the dark hole of creepy clowns and the environment going to kill us all.
Oh, yeah, man. we could fall down some serious rabbit holes in those topics. Probably better for non-podcast talking. Yep.
End it on a happy note. And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News. So a little event's going on up in New York called New York Comic Con. So there's been all kinds of teaser trailers and announcements and stuff like that that's getting released. So we're going to dive a little bit into, some of my favorites or some of the things that I'm anticipating a little bit more. The first thing we got is a little collaboration between Marvel and Netflix. I don't know if you've liked any of their stuff that they've done, but
no,
I think it's
sucked.
Yeah, I think it's actually been one of the greatest collaborations. Just absolutely killing it. In fact, I finished up Luke Cage earlier this week, and
I still haven't had time to watch that. The anticipation of that was so great that it actually shut Netflix down for 2 hours because there was so many people all trying to log in at the same time and watch freaking Luke Cage.
Yeah, it was awesome. Outside of his appearance in Jessica Jones and stuff, I had not really read any of the Luke Cage comics. So
yeah, really, the only thing I know about him is from the Spider-Man animated series. He was a character on the new Spider-Man series that's going on.
Yeah, but I gotta say, I really dug the series. I'm not gonna go into too much detail because I know that between day job and your night job of scaring people, you really haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it. So we'll save, thoughts on that for a later date. But Iron Fist, we got a little bit of a teaser trailer, and I gotta say, I'm excited for Iron Fist.
It's good to see martial arts back on TV again. Internet TV.
Absolutely. I don't know, man. I'm finding myself getting immersed more and more with internet TV than I am, a lot of the primetime stuff, maybe with the exception of S.H.I.E.L.D. and then, a lot of the stuff going on with the CW, which we'll get into in just a little bit as well.
Which you can all watch on an app now, so.
Have you had a chance to play around with the app? I know we talked about it a little bit.
I downloaded it. I haven't really watched anything fully on it because, it was already on the DVR and I happened to be home that night. But pretty much the next day you're getting the new episodes. So if you missed it when it's on and you didn't DVR it, it's going to be on the app. And it looks like they're keeping like the last, they don't have like the entire series, but like the most, like the five most recent episodes
yeah.
are always up. So if you've missed one, as long as you haven't gone 5 weeks, it's it's usually there. And they did do a video because they, whatever, last year they did the whole Superhero Fight Club video.
Yes.
And that was one of the first things they posted on the app, but you can find it on YouTube of the new version now that they've brought Supergirl into the mix. And yeah, the new video is freaking hilarious. And it also has Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses as the
yep.
as the theme. And seeing Cisco try to sing Guns N' Roses is hysterical.
yeah. But yeah, you know, a little bit of a tangent. But I'm really looking forward to Iron Fist. It's going to hit Netflix on March 17th of 2017. Man, the first quarter of 2017 is going to be rocking.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything that we're going to talk about is all happening within that first quarter. The next thing we have is the Power Ranger trailer, man. Like yeah,
that
I
was
gotta
surprising.
Say that, you know, I the Power Rangers felt a little bit kiddish to me. You know, I liked. You know, I'm not going to say that I didn't watch it, but I wasn't as hardcore into it as a lot of my friends were.
Yeah, I
but
watched
I
like the
this
first couple seasons, and then I kind of aged out of it.
Yeah,
because and really, I was probably too old for it when it first came on. Anyway, but I liked the martial arts action, so like I watched a lot of that. But yeah, the new trailer it went dark. I mean, it's like a gritty telling of
yes.
the Power Rangers story.
But I really like you know where it's going into you know how they got the powers and everything else. Rita Repulsa looks
she looks legit scary.
Yes, like I would legit be like. Oh, hell.
And also kind of hot. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, because yeah, I expected another like kiddish movie like you know the last couple. But yeah, this is almost like, I don't know, a few years ago there was a YouTube short film somebody made where it was like a dark, gritty version of the Power Rangers. And it reminds me
yeah,
a lot of
that. Yeah,
the freaking
R-rated Power Rangers, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, I remember us talking about that. And, you know, Power Rangers is going to be happening March 24th of 2017. So... You know, as things get released more, we'll keep folks up to date. But I'm excited. First I was like, oh, another Power Ranger movie. You know, I wasn't too amped up. But now I'm like, all right.
You know? They haven't really showed, like, the Zords or any of the big monster fighting yet. But what this teaser trailer's kind of showed, like, an origin of the team with, like, a little bit of a suit teaser at the end. But, yeah, it looks like it's going to be badass.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to, you know, what it has in store. And I hope that...
The new suits look a little Iron Man-ish, though. They, but they still look badass.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I guess, I mean, that was the thing is, well...
They got a metallicness to them now. So, yeah, they do kind of look more like armor than just dudes in suits with helmets.
Technology has gotten a little bit better, I guess, you know.
Yeah, it's not just a jumpsuit with a helmet anymore. I mean, it looks like they're actually wearing armor.
But another trailer that I came across was Underworld, Blood Wars. And I got to say, I'm pumped for another Underworld movie.
Yeah.
Like, I've been a huge fan of, you know, that whole franchise. So
yeah, I got to go back and watch that because it's been... forever and all those movies kind of blend together at this point, so I can't really keep up with where we're at in the story.
I mean, it's pretty much going to be vampires and werewolves.
Yeah,
I can tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, we might get super vampires and super werewolves or something.
Oh, shit.
I don't know. But
Frankenwolves.
You know, I don't know. I just absolutely love Kate Beckinsale. You know, as
Giggity.
Celine. Yeah, I mean, just I don't know. I'm going to leave it at that. But, you know, I'm super excited. This is set to be released January 6th of 2017. Of course, we'll throw up, you know, links to where folks can find the trailers and everything onto our website. But, yeah, I don't know. Been a huge, huge Underworld fan. Another series that I've been fond of has been Resident Evil, and you know, now we're going to get Resident Evil the Final Chapter, which is said to be, you know, the last film, you know, of the series.
It's a trap. I've heard that before.
Yeah, I feel like I have to you know, this is another one that's going to be happening January of 2017. You know, I got to say, man, as the Resident Evil series has progressed, it's gotten better. You know, the first film, I was like, eh, you know, not so much, but, you know, it's starting to feel more and more like Resident Evil. I don't think anything will compare to, you know, the video game franchise, though.
Yeah,
I
mean, the second one looked like something out, because the first one, they're in the mansion. The second one, they're in Raccoon City. That was probably the most, I mean, even though the story is completely, well, they had the stars, whatever, the Nemesis. There's a lot of the elements of the video games, but the stuff that's come since then, they've kind of ventured off into their own, you know, the characters are there, but as far as the story goes, it's, other than there being zombies and like the bad guys and the heroes that we know, it has been a new series. So I'm interested to see what this last one does. And they're supposedly going back to Raccoon City and whatnot. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing this one.
Yeah, absolutely. So
Mila Jovovich is a badass.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you know, the trailer actually shows her, you know, basically riding the motorcycle into all this gunfire and explosions and just
what you need in a movie.
You know, I just gotta say, like, I'm super excited for it. We talked a little bit about Gears of War yesterday. I know that you know, the new Gears of War game is in the works. You know, but apparently now there is a movie in development by Universal Pictures. Still really preliminary. There really hasn't been any kind of, you know, release dates or anything as of yet. But you know, it's going to, let's see here. It was Rod Ferguson, you know, has basically been talking to folks saying, you know, that, you know, hey, you know, the next step to promote the franchise is to kind of do a movie. And it looks like Scott Stuber from Ted the Kingdom and Dylan Clark, who did Rise of the Planet Apes, are to head the film's development as well.
That sounds good. I mean, traditionally, video game movies have not been entirely successful. I mean, I don't even think that, World of Warcraft movie did too well. So, I mean, Resident Evil's had some length to it. So, I mean, it sounds like they got a good team behind it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not going to be, you know, from what we've been told, you know, not really going to be a direct adaptation of the game. So, you know, I'm just kind of curious to see how they do it. I mean, it has the potential to be really badass if done right. If not, then, you know,
it'll be another one of those, like, flops that we make fun of later on.
Yeah, so
I'm willing to give it a shot. I mean, because it did introduce the game introduced the element of the chainsaw rifle, which I've always kind of wanted.
Yes.
So I want to see that in a, as long as they got a freaking chainsaw rifle in the movie, I'm good.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just wondering, you know, who they're going to get, you know, to star, you know, some of the roles and everything. I don't know. Like,
I mean, Ice Cube did voice some of the characters, I think.
Yeah.
Ice Cube doing, I can't remember the character's name. Get it. Yeah, he's an action star now. You get him to
but
play,
I mean, all these
character,
you know,
that he voiced.
All these freaking Gears guys are, you know, just freaking, you know, in fact, I was looking at one of the cover photos and I see Matt Best, Rocco, and JT.
Oh, shit. That would be awesome.
So, yeah, more to come on that. And then we did get a little bit of a, you know, trailer for the Suicide Squad for the extended cut that they're going to be doing for the DVD. And
are they doing like they did with Superman? It's going to be the R-rated version.
Yeah, that's exactly what they've done. So,
which I don't really agree with that methodology that they've been doing, but if any movie deserves an R-rated version, it's Suicide Squad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was the thing, is, you know, when the movie was in development and everything, I mean, I think originally it did have the R rating, and then they basically tried to go back and rewrite and tone it down a little bit to go for the PG-13, thinking that they were going to attract more fans, but I mean, a film like Suicide Squad, like, I mean, we've seen it with Deadpool, and, you know, you can make a successful R-rated, quote, comic book movie, you know, and I don't know. I think that's one of the reasons why I've really liked the Netflix Marvel team up, but, you know, I think with DC, like, they're going to have to get a little bit more, you know, risque and take more chances, you know. Yep. Marvel's just dominating, you know, from that front. And I think that's one of the reasons why is they're not afraid to, you know, focus on some of the darker elements and, you know, hey, you know, well, this is the way it was in graphic novels and stuff like that. So we're going to keep it gritty. We're going to keep it dark. And, you know, I don't think everything always has to be necessarily kid friendly per se.
Yeah.
So we had a chance to sit down and watch the Flash premiere. What were your thoughts there?
It was good, but I hope they don't drag this Flashpoint multiverse thing out too much longer, because it didn't feel like the traditional team. I mean,
no, it did not feel like Flash. In fact, like, we were watching it and, you know, commenting all along, it's like, this feels like a completely different, but I mean,
it was supposed to,
but
it's an
makes sense
universe.
Because, you know, it's the alternate universe. And, you know, I think that, you know, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the episode, you know, here on out, fast forward, pause, do whatever you need to do. But I think that's one of the reasons why toward the end of the episode, like, I think it's going to maybe be, you know, this next episode, because we've already realized that things are, you know, still not normal.
90% back to normal, but they're not 100% yet. And even because there's going to be they've already said there's going to be a huge, I think it's starts like episode 6 or 7, maybe a 4-episode crossover between all 4 of the new shows. So maybe that's the point where things get back to normal. But yeah, I mean, the new show was good. I just miss my original team and my original feel. And like I said, but I had a crazy fan theory of my own, is that if you remember at the end of season 1, when Flash first goes back to save his mom, there's a Flash, the original Flash that is there, looks at him and like says, no, don't do it. Well, I don't think we've seen that Flash yet. When he goes back again and stops, you know, the reverse Flash from killing his mom, and then eventually fucks up the timeline, and when they try to fix it, he sends him back to finish the job. But I don't think we've seen the Flash that came in and stopped Barry from intervening. So I'm thinking eventually he's going to have to go back and do that before we get back to 100% fixed.
Yes.
So I think we've not seen that particular version of the Flash yet, and it will probably be coming up later on.
Yeah, I did see that, you know, it doesn't look like Superwoman is going to get introduced into the Arrowverse.
Yeah, because that was one of the other theories, too, that they were going to do like a, you know, worlds collide, you know, everything comes back together. Now she's part of this whole nonsense is now that universe is going to be in this universe. But they said she will be crossing over back and forth, you know, because, hell, Barry can travel between worlds, so, and she's supposed to be just as fast as him, which they haven't really showed, like, super speed on that show much, but... Yeah, there's still going to be crossovers, but yeah, they're keeping that world, or at least they're like, she'll be crossing over, but the world will still be separate.
Yes. And, you know, with that, that's what I got. Anything?
Check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com or also on the ESO Network at ESOPodcast.com. Check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Leave us a review. Check us out, on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at Cigar Nerd Pod. And with that, King Kong ain't got nothing on us. We out! And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.